Hello and welcome to The Unique CPA with your host, Randy Crabtree. We're committed to creating a thriving community of accounting professionals who are physically and mentally healthy, fulfilled, and energized by their work. Our ultimate goal is to elevate the reputation of the accounting profession and vastly improve the lives of those in it. The Unique CPA is brought to you by Trimerit, the specialty tax professionals.
Today, our guest is Kurt Mastio. Kurt is the founder of, I guess aptly named, Founder CPA, which he found, that's a lot of founds in one sentence, in 2017. He is currently the managing partner of that firm. Their firm and him personally, their expertise lies in SaaS, blockchain, crypto, fintech industries. His efforts at both leadership and community involvement were recognized when he was awarded the Illinois CPA Society's Outstanding Young Professional Leadership Award in 2020. Lots of other things I can say about Kurt, but we'll talk about it on the show. Kurt, welcome to the Unique CPA.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
And you were very gracious. We had to reschedule once because I don't remember what I was doing, but I think I was maybe heading to Seattle or something like that. Yeah. So, we were just talking before we got on the show, and there's kind of an interesting dynamic going with me today. This is the second episode I'm recording, and the first episode that I recorded today has a similar kind of career path that you did. And so I thought we'd kind of talk about that a little bit. But before we get into that, tell me more about this award you got from the Illinois CPA Society. What was that about?
Yeah, so it's a Young Professionals Leadership Award for both kind of leadership in the accounting industry and outside of the accounting industry and kind of like community involvement and that sort of thing. So I was lucky enough to be selected and got to speak in front of the group, and it was just a really cool experience. So,
and I think one of those community involvements is on your shirt right now. What's that name you're wearing?
Yeah, that is Beat the Streets Wrestling. It's a not-for-profit in the city of Chicago, and was one of the founding members of their Young Professionals Board, and still am involved as and on the board today still, just not in the same capacity, but it's a great organization. So it's something I like to give back and contribute to.
And it's a wrestling organization? Is that what you said?
That's kind of the focal point, but it's more than just that. I mean, it focuses on helping kids from disenfranchised backgrounds really kind of have a safe place to grow and learn. And through the sport of wrestling, like that, it can happen like as a conduit, but not all about wrestling. Like there's enrichment programs, there's mentorship, there's all sorts of things that the not-for-profit does to help kids who just need a little bit extra help, honestly.
Okay. And now I have to ask, do you have a background in wrestling?
Yeah, it was a big sport of mine growing up. So something like that I'm passionate about, and it was a way to give back on something that, again, I care about. So it's just kind of a natural fit after I got introduced.
Oh, that's pretty cool. We have a little bit of a wrestling history in my extended family as well. And it's funny, yesterday I was in an Uber in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the Uber driver that picked me up was a high school national champ wrestler. Wow. You know, but he was at a 98 pounds is what he weighed. And the minimum weight was for college at the time was, I don't even remember I don't know what the minimum weight was, but he was too light for college. He said he got all these Division I scholarship offers, but he was too light, and he could, and they were all predicated on him putting on the weight, and he couldn't put on the weight. Yeah. So he ended up joining the Army, which apparently just paid him to go around and wrestle, which I never knew that was such a thing. So,
yeah.
So as we often do on the show, we've gone on a tangent, but that's one of the requirements, is that we have a good time. So now let's get back to the regularly scheduled program and let's talk about Founder CPAs. But before that, let's just talk about your history, because I think the story we're going to want to talk about today is, you know, the things you've learned starting a firm, growing a firm, managing a firm, but setting the stage of where you came from, I think makes a difference. So how long were you in Big Four, and what was your capacity there?
Yeah, not too long, quite honestly, but it's a little bit of a unique story, I guess. So I kind of took a little bit of a different path, like post-college, in that I finished a semester early and then did an internship with one of the Big Four for what have normally been kind of like the what's a normal second semester, so kind of during the winter time. I was lucky enough to do that internship and then also get a really good opportunity to extend that internship, which actually happened twice. And I got to travel as well as an intern, like, and was flying back and forth between Chicago and Houston on a big project. So might have one of the longer, like, single standing internships at Big Four, but then went back and finished up school after that. So yeah, I guess nice experience there. And then the service line I was specifically in was the forensics group. So think like, you know, financial fraud, corruption, investigative type work. My focus was mostly on like Foreign Corrupt Practices Act at the time. So basically the complete opposite of what I do now, other than spreadsheets for the most part.
All right. And then so this was internship. And then after graduation, you did not go into public accounting then?
No, I did. I went and worked with them full time for about a year and a half, I think is right. I forget the exact timeline, quite honestly, but wasn't there very long. And then after that, you know, I kind of took the next steps in my career, but, you know, had a good experience there, learned a lot, and also learned, like, you know, what it is that I wanted. So,
yeah. So were you one of the, you know, I'm assuming everybody comes in out of college, you're putting in a lot of time and a lot of hours. Is that the way it was?
Yeah, it was a lot of hours. There were like stressful times and that sort of thing. Like there are certainly people who had it worse than me, just with the projects I was on and such, but the hours like didn't bother me as much. I mean, yeah, they weren't great, but I just realized like the bigger type company environment really isn't for me and like my personality type and such. So that was kind of like the reason why I transitioned out rather quickly.
Okay. And I think we'll expand on that in a second. But then just to kind of continue to set the stage, you did not go straight into founding your firm. You then went into industry after the year and a half, or how did, we're not sure. There's an interesting path here.
Yeah. It's a yes and no kind of question. So my soft landing post Big Four was a good friend of mine that I grew up with. I had started a company or a startup while he was actually in college. You know, I'd gotten my CPA during my graduate year, so before I even started working. The joke I kind of share with everybody is as soon as you become a CPA, everybody starts calling you and asking you tax questions and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, as a good friend, like you call me and say, hey, like, I don't know what I'm doing with this stuff. Like, can you help out? And like, my answer is like, hey, I'm a CPA, but I don't do any of that stuff. I don't know any of that stuff. But I, you know, kind of was interested in it and I was willing to help out and, you know, kind of did some moonlighting, supporting that business. And they had like a really big growth year. So when I was ready to leave public accounting, they kind of had like an opportunity to do like a kind of an operational and like kind of fractional CFO role, which sounds funny to say because I didn't know what I was doing at the time. But they had enough to kind of pay me to just really keep the lights on. And so I did that for, I want to say like a year and a half or so. But kind of the agreement was that in parallel to doing that, I would be able to kind of like start taking on other clients, but I at least had kind of enough to feed myself and like keep the lights on in my condo at the time.
All right. So, okay. That's interesting, Troy. While you were talking, I just thought, you know what? I've been doing a lot of these interviews lately where we're talking, you know, to steal the name of your firm, I guess, the founder, but we've been talking to the founder of a firm and going through their story. I think we're going to title these episodes the Founders Series, not stealing your name, but this is, I think, what we're going to, this is my idea that just came to me right now.
Permission granted.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm not going to get sued or anything. I appreciate that. And so you actually talked about this at, I think it was a Illinois CPA Society annual conference where you shared your experiences starting and operating the firm. I think let's kind of talk about that today, but let's talk about, I mean, did you have a business plan in place or is it just like, I'm going to start? I mean, why don't you give us that whole founder story and what you went through?
Yeah, no business plan, never had one, still don't have one to date. I also joke around like, a lot of people ask a question like, oh, did you know you were going to be an entrepreneur from day one and like start an accounting firm? And if you had asked me that in college, I would have said no. Like I never took an entrepreneurship class or anything like that. It was just never really on my radar. So it kind of just happened when I realized like I had good experience in public accounting, realized like that there are parts of that that weren't for me. The things that I did want were things I couldn't get if I was working for someone else. And I enjoyed building and like kind of a higher purpose, I guess. And so that I wasn't going to get that, you know, really working for anyone else.
All right. And so when you started then, which sounded like a kind of almost a gradual start, doing a few things, getting some clients. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you and I talked about before, and one of the things that I'm very passionate about is building a niche practice. So you have a niche practice. There's three different things. But inside that too, one of your niches that you call out is working with startups, right? Mm-hmm. And so was this the plan from the start, or did you just kind of fall into that? But now this is the plan. Give us the whole niching and how that came about and the importance maybe. Let's just expand on niching in general.
Yeah. I'd say that's one of the few things that from the start, like I haven't wavered from or hasn't changed a whole lot. I knew I wanted to work with startup type companies just because it kind of fits my personality of like liking to build things and helping out companies that aren't dealing with like an existing infrastructure and like hurdles that they have to jump over. And you get to be a small part of kind of like helping that growth and seeing the tangible value that you're adding. So yeah, that was always kind of the approach from day one, really just because of a kind of a personal passion and interest of mine. And for a while, I was actually looking at like being in an internal role at a startup or something, or like starting a startup company. But I realized like I can't code, I can't like sell, I can't market. So what am I going to do? Got to be accounting.
Well, all you had to do is wait another 10 years or 5 years or 6 years, and then you got AI that could start coding this stuff for you. And
yeah.
All right. So let's dig deeper into the niche, though. Specifically right now, let's talk blockchain and crypto, because that's a topic that everybody wants to understand and nobody, I think, does understand.
Yeah.
But let's talk from the whole accounting and tax end of things, or wherever you think's the most interesting. Maybe it's how you just deal with these clients. The client base is different. What are the uniquenesses of dealing with that industry?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest unique is you're operating without a set of rules, or at least a understandable set of rules, because it is such a unique space and innovation happens so quickly that, you know, if you look at the IRS and like tax code, right? There's a lot of things that blockchain and startup companies that are blockchain and crypto companies are doing that don't fit like within an area of the code. They kind of really fall like right in the middle of certain things, or they don't exist altogether. Mm-hmm. Same thing on the financial reporting side. Is there gap guidance for this particular transaction? And oftentimes the answer is no. So that's one of like the most unique things. And I think for a lot of people, they'd find that like frustrating and hate it. But I kind of enjoy the challenge of that and helping try to navigate as best we can.
All right. So maybe let's dig into some specifics, because it is not, like you said, the IRS code doesn't address it. You know, the gap rules may not be there. You know, so you have to use your best judgment. And so what are some of the things that are you're having to make these good judgments on, and how do you base it on? What guidance are you finding? Is it other parts of the tax code? Mm-hmm. How do you get into that?
Yeah, I guess like the best way to, or it's a simple example, maybe not so simple because nothing is simple in that space, but I think of like equity-based compensation. So issuing incentive stock options or non-qualified stock options, restricted stock awards, et cetera. Crypto companies have started to do the same if they have their own native blockchain asset, right? So you go to work for a crypto company and they have their own token, right? They may offer compensation in the form of that token. And the regulatory battle that's happening in DC right now is like, you know, are cryptocurrencies a security or not, right? And we know for tax purposes that, you know, equity compensation falls under certain rules, right? Whereas in this case, token compensation isn't equity, right? But it looks and behaves a lot like equity. So for the most part, you treat it the same, but then there's just some weird like nuances and differences that like aren't factored into the existing code, right? Like vesting is common, right, with equity compensation, but what about vesting and like lockup periods and that sort of thing? Or what if it's locked up and the person never claims it? There's just a number of different things that, quite honestly, like we're still hoping and waiting for answers on.
Right.
But to answer your question around like how do you navigate that, you kind of have to look at what it looks most like, right? And then kind of use skepticism and say, okay, if I'm arguing otherwise, like what are the gaps in this treatment or the holes in this treatment that need to be considered? And when you don't, unfortunately, have like definitive guidance to go off of, and you're working with clients who are trying to like solve those problems, you have to just disclose like, hey, here's the issues at hand. Here's what, you know, it looks most like. Like, we've got to make a judgment call. Here's what your risks and downsides are in that scenario.
can you, and I just was thinking about this, can you actually do an audited financial statement for somebody in this? Is there enough guidance to be able to follow things?
I think like Coinbase and some others might be audited. So it's happening already, but I would love to be a fly on the wall in some of those conversations.
Oh, because
we do have clients that are working towards like being audited, right? And they're in the crypto space. And they also have like regulatory requirements that require audited financials, et cetera. And to answer your question, like I kind of say the same thing as it is on the tax side. Like if you don't have definitive guidance, right? You need to work with the audit, whoever your auditor is, and understand like what they're comfortable with signing off on and like what needs to be disclosed and that sort of thing. But it's similar, but a different set of problems on the financial reporting side that we just don't have the frameworks that we need and the guidance that we need to be able to do things in a compliant way. Because what is compliant in this space?
Yeah, I was helping my son with his tax return this year. And oh, what was that? There's a company out there called... Oh, my mind's blank. But supposedly you can upload like your Excel sheets that you can get from Coinbase, and they're going to look at all the transactions and spit out a report of gain or loss on that. And I couldn't figure out how to work it.
I mean, so that's really good marketing by that company, right? Because I'm sure on their site it says, yeah, just plug everything in, connect to your wallets, and then you're good to go. Like you've got your tax reports, but it's the same concept as like QuickBooks Online, right? You can set everything up, but if you don't know what you're doing with the software, you don't know how to make the software do what you want it to do or what it needs to do,
right?
The results you're going to get are not accurate. And we see that all the time on the crypto tax side. Like the hardest part is just getting the data in there and manipulating it. Like then the software can figure out the reports and calculate your gains and losses and all that.
Right. And I know IRS has come out with more guidance on it. It just doesn't seem like it's that in depth yet. I'm assuming in the next few years they're going to be requiring a lot more reporting from these crypto companies,
yeah,
at least from the investment side of things.
Yeah, I mean, IRS is already understaffed, doesn't have the budget for it, and then they're faced with this problem. So it'll be an interesting one to see how it unfolds or evolves over time.
Okay. Well, let's talk about another one of your expertise or your expertise, your company's expertise, companies you like to work with. One of your niches, which is, again, one of my favorite things to talk about, is the fintech industry. Tell me about, actually, I hear fintech all the time. Can you define fintech for me?
Sure. I mean, there's some bit that overlaps a little bit with like our crypto clients, right? So, you know, it might be a money transmitter or a payment platform or something like that. Really, fintech, to me at least, and I'm sure you could look on Google and find 1,000 different definitions, but
right,
it's really just technology that augments the financial industry, right? Or the financial profession. But it also, I guess, can encompass like, you know, actual fintech tools like investment management and that sort of thing. Fintech's an interesting one for us though, because we don't have a ton of clients like within that specific niche like alone. I would say, again, there's a lot of overlap between like blockchain and fintech, because we have some companies that are in the blockchain space that kind of provide a fintech type service. So like that kind of sub niche, I guess, like blockchain, crypto, fintech, and then SaaS is really a drill down on like what I would call just a venture-backed technology company. Within that, though, there's still certain companies that we stray away from, like, you know, if you're consumer packaged goods or something like that, even if you're VC-backed, you're probably not going to be the best fit for us. But those are like the highest concentration of clients, like blockchain, crypto, fintech, and then SaaS. But that doesn't mean that there aren't others that are in some other sub-niche.
So when you're looking at your niches, then, you know, this is, I mean, creating a niche is positive for a lot of things. You can become an expert in this area. You can show that you have this knowledge. How do you go about marketing or business development when you are this expert in these specific areas?
Interesting. Every single time I'm talking to someone who doesn't know about the business or is like asking about the company, I always get asked like, how do you find clients? Like, why are people contacting you? And that's actually one of the first things I ever focused on is inbound marketing. So putting content out there and letting people find that content, because it does a couple of things. Like number one, it establishes expertise and evidence for you in that particular domain. But number two, it also helps you attract like the right client that you're looking for, the right customer, right? So, you know, sometimes ad buying, like if you're just purchasing ads on Google or something like that, it might be, you know, business tax return is what you're targeting. Where in reality, like we want a startup who's most likely to be a Delaware C Corp. they're searching certain things on the internet that we rank for, we have content out there for, and so they're finding us because they have a little bit more specific intent.
So is most of your new business then coming to you from this?
From inbound, yeah, which I think is somewhat unique in the accounting space. I think it's mostly been like outbound sales and referral based, but yeah, yep. We've been inbound.
Yeah, I'm pretty fortunate. I've interviewed a few people in the last couple months that have had that same type. I don't know if you know Brandon Hall at all, the real estate CPA. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard the name. I don't know him personally, though.
Yeah, well, probably you know him on Twitter or something.
Yeah.
And I saw you, your company has quite a few followers on Twitter. So that's, I guess it kind of in that technology space where probably that's where people are hanging out. But so Brandon was the same thing. He was telling me about how many inbound leads he gets, and he just gets to go through them and pick and choose what are the ones that are the best fit for him. So I really like that about the modern, I'm going to call you the modern firm, the startup. Well, you help startups, but you are a startup really as well. Yeah. That they've figured that out to do, you don't have to go all these evening cocktail hours to try to meet, somebody that maybe is a potential or join the country club or whatever. It makes things a lot better. How about your firm in general then? Other uniqueness or other things that you've done that you think are, maybe not necessarily unique to you, but that you're doing different than Big Four? The things that you saw that you could change, things that you feel help you be more efficient, just other things from productivity standpoint. What do you guys, any things there?
Yeah, I'll go back to and take it as a compliment earlier when you said like modern firm, because I think tech enablement or tech adoption is a big part of what we do a little bit different. So our team is trained on our tech stack, like our clients are trained on the tech stack, and like we kind of utilize an industry best practice tech stack, like with working with our clients, because our team can do more when we have the right tools in place versus like, even if we have great processes and great people, if we don't have the right tools, like it's just going to take longer to do those things. And like, we can't price the same with clients, et cetera. So that's, I think, one big thing that differentiates us a little bit. The other is, I think, a focus on work-life balance, which it's a genuine focus. It's not just fluff, I guess.
Right.
Because like we're going back to the whole content marketing thing, like if you get that right and you have an abundance of leads and you're not operating in a scarcity mindset, like wondering where your next client's going to come from because you typically get them from referrals, like that leads to an environment where you're going above and beyond to retain clients who may not be the right fit for you, but also doing that so you can get that next client in the door. But when you figured out that like marketing and lead funnel and you have optionality around like working with the right clients, it gives you a little bit more autonomy in terms of managing workload and really kind of living true to that work-life balance thing. I mean, that being said, like there's times like where, hours are a little bit worse than others, but typically, especially on the accounting side, on average, it's a 40 to 45 hour work week, even during like busier times like month-end close and such.
All right. And how about, so is tax season a heavy time for you then, or are you more accounting-based?
Accounting is the bigger part of the practice, but we're certainly busy during the tax time. So those hours like for staff are closer to like a 50 hour to 55 maybe, which is still way better than 70, 80 hours as you hear about in public accounting. The one unique thing, I guess, about working with venture-backed startups, which kind of I won't like take credit for, pretend like it was some genius idea, is that a lot of tech startups, or most tech startups, actually operate at a loss, right? So if you're talking about extensions, you can extend companies that are operating at a loss, and you don't have to worry as much about like estimates and that sort of thing. I mean, there's some state stuff you have to take care of, but by doing that, you can kind of spread the work out a little bit more throughout the year. I mean, that being said, like we'll also work with startup founders who, on the individual side, so we still have some of that bottleneck, but the venture-backed C-Corp is surprisingly like a good tax client just from a capacity planning standpoint.
And how about from a tax planning standpoint then? Because if we are in no tax situation, there's probably still things that we want to make sure we take advantage of, even if it's not going to be a current year benefit. Is that obviously not something happening March 15th? This is something that you're dealing with throughout the year? Or how does tax planning work with a company that's not profitable?
Yeah, I guess for a company that's not profitable, to think like your traditional like venture-backed C-Corp, a lot of it comes down to things like R&D tax credit studies is one big one where we'll do a lot of work there. But there's also I guess, less on the planning side. It's more compliance. And this can be tricky, like state and local tax matters, especially for SaaS companies, understanding like when you have a sales tax nexus in a particular state and even like income tax nexus, especially now that the world's become a little bit more remote from a work standpoint. That's particularly challenging because, you know, people are hiring all over the place and they may have established an income tax nexus in a new state because of hiring an employee there and they may have some customers there.
Right.
And then the rules around SaaS in particular, you know, some states tax it for sales tax, some don't. And then the ones that do have weird carve outs. So it keeps us busy, I guess, during the downtime between that and R&D tax credits.
So from a SALT standpoint, do you have an internal expert on that?
We don't have like someone who would consider themselves to be a SALT expert.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that like it's augmented by technology, like, you know, research tools like Bloomberg and such. Like they have really good portfolios and matrices that kind of help you walk you through exposure in different states and that sort of thing. But there's still the human element that you have to have looking at it.
Right. And then from the R&D standpoint, a lot of your companies probably being in the tech space and that are going to qualify. And so when you're talking R&D tax credit, I'm assuming you're talking the startup credit that you can use to offset payroll taxes for most of these companies?
Yep, exactly. That's the majority of them will apply it that way.
All right. And these new rules that just kicked in where now you can get up to, you know, up to $500,000 of credit to offset payroll taxes. Is that going to benefit any of your clients?
Yeah, it can. I haven't done like an analysis to say which ones in particular it will, because we're doing their credit regardless of
right.
whether or not they get 500 or 250. So.
Right. And then when you're doing the credit, because the end of the rules, the old rules were before this year, that 250,000 could be used to offset payroll taxes in any given year. Mm-hmm. And it was employer portion of Social Security taxes. Now it's employer portion of Social Security taxes and Medicare taxes. Went from 250,000 now to 500,000. And so the benefit could be nice. And this, you have that client base that really can benefit nicely from that. If you had anything above 250 in the past, obviously you're just carrying that forward on the return and, mm-hmm. and hopefully they'll use it. Or in reality, it's probably an asset on a sale. Is that what happens to a lot of your startups? They ended up getting, you know, bought by someone else once they become, you know, whatever they're doing becomes successful?
Yeah, we've had a lot of clients that have exited, even in like the last 12 months alone, to several companies that you would recognize. And I can't really
share
much beyond that. But like, you know, big tech startups. So yeah, we've seen kind of like from start, seed kind of stage through scale and exit, which is kind of cool though too, because, you know, you start working with a client when they're just starting off on an idea and then they get to sell their company and you know that you're a small part of that. That's kind of a cool feeling.
Yep.
Going back to the R&D tax credit, I'm sure you're aware of this and have heard similar things, but there is a lot of kind of coaching that has to happen with like tech startups, because there's been a lot of companies that have popped up kind of in like the robo-advisor type
yep.
software space that are reaching out to companies saying, yep, we can get you all this money.
Yep.
And the first thing I do when we talk to a client that we're doing an R&D tax credit study for is I say, look, from a business standpoint, I understand you might say everything is R&D. Unfortunately, from the IRS's standpoint, their definition is very different and we have to fit like within those rules.
Yep.
So like, it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yep, for sure. I've been through all that as well. I think we should probably start wrapping up. I the whole story of the, you know, the niche you're dealing with and how you work with, I guess the one thing we didn't touch on, and I would be curious because I pretty much ask anybody that's doing things a little different from a billing standpoint, are you selling hours or are you have a different model in place?
That's been an ongoing evolution. So I guess, One kind of additional piece of context is like at the beginning of this year, like we formally merged in with another accounting firm.
Oh.
It was a little bit smaller than us, kind of the complete opposite of what the model is that I had at the time, and that it's really just partners and no staff. And previously it was myself and a bunch of staff, right? So like marrying kind of like the two billing styles, I guess, or billing techniques or whatever you want to call it, has been an ongoing kind of process. Like you don't really just transition that overnight.
Yep.
But to answer your question, like historically have done mostly value-based billing or fixed fee. Like I know there are differences for sure, but that's generally what the client craves. at the same time, what we started to find, especially working with fast-growing startups, and the larger we got, the less like hands-on or in the weeds I was with certain clients, we were getting burned quite a bit on scope creep. And you know, the individuals who may have been managing that particular client, like, weren't trained on value-based pricing or scope management and that sort of thing. And you know, we had kind of different priorities taking precedent. And so that wasn't necessarily happening. And so we kind of put a mechanism in place, and we're doing a little bit of a hybrid right now where, you know, it's a fixed or value-based price. But you know, if there's certain overages, like, we're going to have to just bill for that time. But it's kind of constrained in that, like, we don't want to have to sign an engagement letter for, you know, a state registration or probably something even less simple or more simple than that. So we kind of have like a hybrid model at the moment, if that makes sense.
Okay. No, it makes sense. And I would think it'd be a little harder for you to even get into subscription pricing just with dealing with startups, because things can change so quick on that, and what they need from you would change. So I think that's the one area where maybe, because talking with Ron Baker, I don't know if you know Ron, but talking with Ron, he's basically, and I love Ron, but he was basically saying anybody could do a subscription, and you maybe could, but I think personally it would be harder for the companies you deal with. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
I think so, especially if someone's not, like, you know, whoever's managing that particular project isn't really trained up on like value-based pricing and scope management and that sort of thing.
Yep.
Because things can change overnight with a startup. And then even at this, like, we have certain things in our engagement letter that say, like, if transaction volume goes up by X amount, or like you raise a fundraising round, or like certain things happen, like, we've got to revisit the agreement. But I also see like companies that price based off transaction volume. And to me, that makes no sense, because you can have a company with 1,000 transactions a month that it's all the same transactions. It's relatively simple, right?
Yep.
And then a company with 100 transactions that are really complex. It's a bunch of accruals, like all that kind of stuff. And you can't price those the same. So we do a little bit more of a deep dive on the discovery side, and like really take our time when we're pricing things out with clients, rather than kind of rely on some arbitrary metric.
Okay. So let's just to wrap up the pricing or billing. Are you keeping track of hours?
Yeah, so the team does track their time. We don't keep track of metrics like utilization or anything like that. To me, those are kind of vanity KPIs or meaningless, because they can be manipulated and that sort of thing. The reason we're doing it is to have a benchmark of, like, you know, scope creep and profitability with the client. I don't care if something's 10% over budget or whatever it may be. I'm looking for huge outliers, which time tracking I know is not particularly precise, but it is going to give you at least a general sense of like what is going into a particular client and identify issues.
Yep.
Whereas on the other side, you have to have like trained, skilled managers who are able to manage that scope creep and like manage the client in the engagement.
Okay. All right. So I think we're going to slow down the conversation there. All right. So two final questions, you know, and I think we talked about this a little at the beginning already, but there's probably other things as well besides running the firm and working with your clients. What's your outside of work passions? What do you love doing when you're not working?
Yeah. I'm going to sound very boring here, I feel like, but I kind of like typical type stuff, I guess. Really, really big Chicago Cubs fan. I'm a season ticket holder.
Yes!
So. So I'm just love sports and watching games and attending them, spending time with friends and family. I also have a dog who is four, a little bit over
Rufus?
Four now. Rufus, yeah.
All right.
He's great. But yeah, I mean, I like to golf. So it tends to all like sound like it's sports related. Not a great golfer, but I love to get out. So, and then an involvement in kind of extracurricular, you know, beat the streets type stuff, which
right.
I wish I could be more involved in. It's one of my goals. But yeah, so it sounds super boring. I don't have a great, like, oh, I climb mountains or cross-country skied.
Nope, that is fine. In fact, so I'm going to be in D.C. next week. And again, this will probably air months after you and I are talking right now. Guest of the National Restaurant Association, and they're take me, I think, a skybox against the Nationals are playing the Cubs. So I'm pretty excited. I get to go out there and watch the Cubs game. So that'll be fun.
Oh, I guess I thought of something that's unique about me. It's not like that interesting, but I do teach. I have been teaching at Northwestern University in their undergraduate program for, I think, since 2016. I'm like terrible with dates, but for a while now, I teach a class or co-teach a class called Accounting and Finance for Startups. So I've taught hundreds of students at this point, and so that's fun. Like it's work, but it's a different kind of work. I like working with students and, you know, passionate people who are trying to get ideas off the ground and that sort of thing. So
Yep. One of my passions is just educating. I do webinars and whatnot all the time. And this is education we're doing here today. And this is what I really like to do. So, all right, then last final question. If people want to find out more about you or find out about the firm or things that you're doing, where would they get more information?
Yeah. Our website for the firm is founderscpa.com. And then like if you're looking to contact us, there's a contact us form. I'm also available on LinkedIn. I think it's just like LinkedIn and then my full name, Kurt Mastio, and happy to chat, you know, really in any capacity, especially if people are looking for something a little bit different in their careers. Like I mentioned earlier, we are hiring for several open roles right now. And the only thing that's holding us back from a growth perspective is having those right people.
Nice. Awesome. Well, Kurt, it was fun. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed learning about the firm and what you're doing and the uniqueness. Oh, you fit the unique CPA. There you go. The uniqueness that you're doing. And so thanks again. And I'm sure you and I will be in touch talking again at some point in time, hopefully somewhere. Maybe we'll go grab a beer in Chicago or something.
Yeah, hopefully we cross paths again soon. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today on The Unique CPA. You can find the show notes for today's episode and learn more about TriMerit at theuniquecpa.com. Remember to subscribe and leave a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting app. And join us next time for more expertise and insights on The Unique CPA. Professional Productions.net.